Hello, everybody, and welcome to another beautiful Thursday morning. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network, and I have a great show planned for all of you today. Maren McKenna will be joining me. She's an award-winning author and journalist who specializes in public health, global health, and food policy issues, and I'll be telling you more about her in just a little bit. But first, I want to share with you some things going on in and around the city, our country, some things you should be involved with, some events coming up, and of course share my weekly recipe with you. So, this was a big weekend. This weekend was a Women's March, which took place in New York and California and Washington, took place everywhere. There were over 200 protesters in New York, over 600,000 in Los Angeles, over 300,000 in Chicago, and thousands in Washington and cities all across the country. I know my assistant was in Seattle. She went to one. I was in Cincinnati, went to one. There were just marches in every major city, and even in small towns they had marches. I know in New Jersey of one that was, last year there was like 7,000 people. This year there were 15,000 people. So even smaller towns really gathered women together, and not just women, men joined them as well, to really speak out and protest the current administration and also push back against, the Time's Up campaign and the Me Too campaign and, addressing sexual harassment and the Republicans' attempt to defund Planned Parenthood and freedom with our bodies and all of that, all clumped together. So many different issues, but whenever we see huge numbers of people taking to the streets to create social change, it just warms my heart. We need to do more of that. We cannot compete with the big corporations and their money and the administration that's in our White House right now, but we do have people power. And we really need to show that people power, and the way to do that is to get out onto the streets. So this weekend was really great. Also, the NOFA New York 36th Annual Winter Conference took place this past weekend. I was there on Friday only. I drove up and back in the one day so that I could do my cooking demo, which was wonderful. I got to share my recipe for an Asian stir fry, an Indian vegetable coconut curry, and a Mediterranean vegetable with fire roasted tomatoes, olives, and capers. And basically, I call that class my one wok, three meal class. And it's just wonderful to demonstrate how easy it is with bowls of the same vegetables to create three completely different national or international dishes from around the world, using just delicious, fresh, organic vegetables. And it's always a wonderful opportunity to share my passion with everybody. And then, of course, there was so much left over. I was able to share samples with everyone. And the carrot cake recipe that I shared last week, I made that as well so that I could give everybody a little sample of how good a gluten-free vegan carrot cake could be. And so I just get charged by meeting all the people that were up there and, all the farmers and the food producers and everybody with such great energy coming together to really help promote healthy food in our communities. And so, the NOFA conference is always a wonderful opportunity. And every state in the Northeast has their winter conference, Connecticut, Massachusetts, Vermont. So this was the New York one, and it was just really, really great. Some things coming up that you want to know about. Of course, Restaurant Week is going on right now, and it's an opportunity to check out some of the restaurants that otherwise might be outside of your reach. They have price-fixed meals. Saturdays are excluded in most of the restaurants, but lunch and dinner is available, and you can go on to the Restaurant Week website and find out what restaurants are participating and take advantage of it. Lunches are $29 and dinners are $42. And they're just wonderful opportunities to try some really great food. January 24th, there's an event taking place called the Future of Sustainable Food, and it's being sponsored by a new social action group called Be Social Change. And you can find them online at besocialchange.com. And they are building the largest social impact community around. That's their goal. And if you join in the month of January, you can be a founding member. Richard McCarthy, the executive director of Slow Food, will be there on the panel, as well as a whole list of other people. And this is a panel discussion sharing insights on trends, challenges, opportunities for the sustainable food future. So check that out. That's Wednesday, January 24th, and it will take place at Prime Produce, which is on 54th Street between 9th and 10th Avenue. Also, January 25th, a really wonderful event is taking place called Ingredient. It's an evening with chef and biochemist Dr. Ali Buzari, and it's taking place at the Boulay Botanical Kitchen on 281 Church Street in Tribeca. And it's an opportunity, it's a crash course in what foodies should know about how food works, and it will be talking about food and the makeups of food. And following the presentation, there will be a wellness-inspired, biodynamic, multi-course wine dinner created by Chef David Boulay. So check that out. January 28th is the Healing America Tour, and this is a plant-pure movement promoting plant-based eating, and it's a conference going on all day, and admission is free, and you should check that out. It's at the Walt Whitman High School in Huntington, Sunday, January 28th from 3 to 5. And there is also a screening of An Inconvenient Sequel. That's Al Gore's second movie following The Inconvenient Truth. And that will be taking place at the New York Society for Ethical Culture on Sunday, January 28th. On January 29th, the Food Almanac 2018 conference in New York City will be taking place with Slow Food New York City. And this is always a great event. I try to go every year. It's at Project Farmhouse, which is on 76 East 13th Street. And this is their eighth year of doing this Food Almanac. And they put together a panel of experts this year. It will be discussing the next generation of farmers and growing urban agriculture and climate change. So that should be a really interesting evening. It's always a great event. Really nice snacks and drinks are put out. So I hope to see you there. February 1st, Building an Urban Farming Business Plan, hosted by AgTechX. That will be on my website also. February 2nd through the 11th is a wonderful 10-day conference that's taking place out at the Hilton Hotel in Melville. And this has over 35 top authors and experts on health and food and science and doctors. And, you know, they will be talking about the different health benefits of eating plant-based food. And it's, you know, there's a huge schedule, so you should go online to see the schedule because I can't even list them all. But it's February 2nd through the 11th. It's free. You can also stream it online, so it's definitely worth checking out. Just Google the Real Truth About Health conference, and you'll get the whole printout of who will be there. On February 6th, at Pace University, NRDC, the Natural Resource Defense Council, will be having a food law initiative event talking about different issues in food law. And that's also taking place at Project Farmhouse, which is a really wonderful new space open to foodie organizations that want to have public events. And it's really a beautiful new space. I've gone to a couple things there already, and I really recommend checking that out. The Organic Seed Alliance, who I interviewed Michaela Coley a couple weeks ago on my website, who is the program director for the Organic Seed Alliance. They're having their annual conference from Wednesday through Friday, February 14th through 17th in Oregon. If you live out that way or you can head out that way, it's a wonderful opportunity to learn about seed saving and seed choosing the best seeds and things that you want to know about seeds. So that's a, you know, 3-day conference, definitely worth checking out. And I have so much more on my website. I don't want to take the time to go through all of them, although I do want to mention that February 28th, the 4th annual Food Tank Summit is coming up at, in Washington, D.C., and I've gone to those each year, and they're just a great, great conference. So many different presenters and experts in their field come out for that conference, so check that out. So anyway, like I said, on my website at ieatgreen.com, you can go to the events and you can see all these wonderful events that are taking place. I want to share my recipe. This week's recipe is seitan marsala. Seitan, for those of you that do not know, seitan is wheat meat. It's the high concentrated protein in wheat. Not for those with celiac, but for everybody else who's trying to cut down on animal products, this is a wonderful, wonderful protein alternative. And seitan marsala is one of the dishes that I make whenever I'm catering for people, especially people that are not traditionally vegetarians and are looking for something more meaty or substantial at an event. I make this seitan marsala because it looks so much like something they're familiar with. This original recipe does use butter and egg, but I'll talk, as I'm telling you about the recipe, I'll tell you how you can substitute it to make it vegan if you would like to do that. So I start with 2 packages of seitan, White Wave or Raise are some of the my favorite brands that are out there. I also love making my own seitan, and I do have a basic seitan recipe on my website that you can also download and learn how to just make seitan from scratch. But if you want, are looking to not make it from scratch, which is a, you know, more of a long process, you can buy the packaged seitan. And you want the slices as opposed to the chunks if you're buying it. And I used 1 organic egg that I beat in a little bowl, 1 cup of breadcrumbs. You can combine regular whole wheat breadcrumbs with panko breadcrumbs. And then I season it with some Italian spices like oregano, basil, some garlic powder, some salt and pepper. Then you want some olive oil for sautéing. You can also bake the seitan in the oven if you are looking to use less oil. 1 pound of mushrooms. I use the baby portobellos, but you can use plain white mushrooms too. 1 stick of butter, marsala wine, tamari, 4 cloves of garlic, flour, salt and pepper, thyme, and some poultry seasoning. Poultry seasoning is just a combination spice mix, which you can make up yourself. You can Google a recipe, or you can just, you know, make a mixture of parsley, sage, rosemary, thyme, marjoram, those kind of things that go into a stuffing. That's the kind of flavor palette that you're looking for. So if you have your own seitan, you're going to slice it into 1/4-inch thick slices, or if you are buying the seitan, you'll just use the slices that they already have cut out there. And you're going to press it lightly between a dish towel just to absorb some of the water that it comes packed in or the sauce that it comes packed in to dry it. And then you're going to bread it by dipping it into the egg mixture and then into the breadcrumb mixture, just like you would eggplant parmesan or chicken cutlets or anything like that. And you're going to bread the pieces of seitan. Now, if you are looking to do this vegan, you can mix some flaxseed or some chia seed, ground chia seeds, either one. If you mix them with some water or a little apple cider vinegar, they become very glutinous and they can be a substitute for egg. And so you can do that. and then still dip it into the breadcrumbs. You can also, well, there's no reason to use gluten-free breadcrumbs because the seitan is also wheat. So this dish is not for those who are looking for gluten-free. And then instead of the stick of butter, you can just use olive oil when you're making the roux or coconut oil. And you're going to either cover the bottom of a pan, a sauté pan, with some olive oil and sauté each of the pieces of seitan that are breaded until they're golden and crispy on each side. Or you can take a cookie sheet and spray it with some olive oil spray and lay the pieces down on the parchment paper and bake it in the oven until it's golden brown, about 15 minutes on one side, and then turn them over and do about 10 minutes on the other side. And they'll come out golden brown that way too, and you're using a lot less oil. So I've been doing it that way a lot lately as well. In another sauce pan, you want to saute the mushrooms in the 2 tablespoons of, or the 4 cloves of garlic and the 2 tablespoons of butter. And I also put a little olive oil in there. And like I said, if you want to not do the butter, you can do just olive oil or olive oil and coconut oil. And you're going to saute the mushrooms until they're soft. You're going to add 1 or 2 tablespoons of Marsala wine into that and keep sauteing it until the wine burns off and gets absorbed into the mushrooms. And then you're going to remove the mushrooms and just set them in a bowl on the side and wipe out the pan and use the same pan again to make the gravy. And so to make the sauce, you're going to melt the 6 tablespoons of butter in the heavy cast iron pan. And you're going to mix it with 6 tablespoons of flour. Like I said, if you don't want to use the butter, you can use olive oil or coconut oil instead. And then you're going to mix it with the flour, and using a whisk, you're going to cook it over medium heat until it turns a light brown color. And you do want to give it time to toast the flour to get that brown color, because that's going to be the color of the gravy. So depending on how brown you make that roux, which is what the butter and flour mixture is called, that will depend on the color the mushroom gravy is going to be when you're finished. And then you're going to add 1/4 cup of Marsala wine to that. Keep whisking, and it's going to get even thicker when you first add the Marsala wine. And then you're going to add 2 cups of water or vegetable stock to that. And keep whisking it until you have no clumps and it gets the consistency you want. I add 1 tablespoon of tamari, some salt and pepper to taste, 1/4 teaspoon of poultry spice, and a sprinkle of some thyme. And mix that up and then taste it and adjust the spices to your liking. If you want a little more poultry spice in there for a little bit more aromatic flavor, you can do that. Or you want just more thyme, you can do that. And then I lay the seitan out onto a platter, and I drizzle the mushroom gravy right down the center, and it just looks beautiful. And then you can garnish it with some fresh parsley. And like I said, it's really one of those dishes that you really are going to feel like you're having a main course, and then you would have a side grain and vegetable with it, and you really feel like you're having a complete meal. And it's just very satisfying, and it's really great for company. So if you make this, let me know. I love hearing feedback from everybody when you make the recipes. And now I do want to also just tell you a couple things that are going on that you want to sign some petitions that I have on my website. I always like to make sure that, you know, people are going to my website and signing these petitions, because like I said at the beginning of our talk, that it's really important that we show up and get out to the streets. The Women's March was a great opportunity, but right now, you know, Trump has opened up all of our waters for drilling, and we really don't want that to happen. You remember the BP disaster that happened in the Gulf of Mexico? Not only did it kill people, but then it, you know, destroyed the wildlife living in the Gulf of Mexico. And he's looking to open up 90% of our coast to this offshore drilling, and it's just ridiculous. So please go onto my website and sign the petition for that, and demand that they not allow drilling to happen in our oceans. There's also a petition for a replacement for NAFTA, the trade agreement that has not worked out the way that it was intended, and we need to replace that. trade agreement and make, you know, trade with other countries a little bit fairer all the way around. It's really hurt the workers and has not ended up being profitable or good for our country or for the workers. Also, school food. You know, I'm very, very passionate about school lunches and trying to get school meals healthier. And the Obama administration really worked towards that. Michelle Obama was a tremendous force in trying to improve the school lunch programs, and she got a lot of pushback, and now Trump is trying to undo all of that. So please sign the petition on my website for making school meals healthy again and to keep the new rules that the Obama administration had put into place to keep them happening, because we were going in the right direction. We do not want to do a turnaround on that front. So on that note, I would like to introduce to you my guest today, Maren McKenna. She's a, like I said before, an award-winning journalist and author, and she writes about public health issues and food policy. And her new book called The Big Chicken, The Incredible Story of How Antibiotics Created Modern Agriculture and Changed the Way the World Eats, came out this year and has been, you know, getting the recognition that it deserves. It was the best food book by Civil Eats in 2017, and it was named the best science book by Amazon and Smithsonian Magazine. And she writes for so many different wonderful papers, the New York Times Magazine, the Smithsonian, the Atlantic, NPR, Newsweek. She's just, you know, doing great, great work, and I'm just thrilled to have Maren on with us today. Maren, are you with me?
I'm here. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for joining me. Your book is great, and it is so important for people to really kind of hear the message and the work that you're doing. So can you tell us a little bit about The Big Chicken and how you came to write this book?
Sure. So Big Chicken is the story of how we came to give antibiotics routinely to most of the meat animals on the planet, which I think is a thing that most people don't know about, and how that routine use of antibiotics has contributed to a worldwide epidemic of drug-resistant infections. And that story is kind of wrapped in a second story, which is the story of the rise of industrial-scale poultry production. And that story is critical to the story of antibiotics, because chickens were the first animals to get experimentally the antibiotics that are now used routinely on large farms. And in the United States, it looks like chicken is going to be the first sort of sector of the protein economy that's going to exit routine antibiotic use because of consumer demand. So these two stories, which are really kind of the stories of science in the 20th century and the stories of how we got the food system that we have today, really kind of fit together.
Mm-hmm. Let's backtrack just a little bit. How did you get into writing about food and food policy issues? Was this your passion, or how did that come to be?
So I've always been interested in food, but as a profession, I've always been a science writer, and it's always been very difficult for me to kind of wrench my writing around to the food that fascinated me. My training is really as a investigative journalist working primarily in public health, and I have investigated the health effect of nuclear weapons plants on nearby communities and the occurrence of Gulf War syndrome in soldiers who came back from the First World War, and I've been to many, many, many disease outbreaks with the disease detectives of the CDC. And a number of years ago, I got interested in the problem of antibiotic resistance, how it was that we were overusing antibiotics and misusing them and causing this epidemic of drug-resistant infections to arise. And I thought initially that was a problem just in medicine, and I wrote a book a few years ago called Superbug, which describes the problem of antibiotic resistance. But as I was researching that, I stumbled across a statistic that completely knocked me back on my heels, which was that in the United States, we sell four times as many antibiotics for use in livestock as we do for use in humans. And when I heard that, first I thought, how could so many livestock be sick? And then I discovered that, in fact, the livestock are not sick, but that we give antibiotics to livestock to increase their rate of growth, to make them get fat faster, and also to protect them against the conditions of industrial-scale farming that they're raised in. That's what makes very large-scale farms possible. And when I realized that we were using most antibiotics in livestock not for reasons of curing infections, which is what we do in medicine, I was completely shocked. Because I had just exited this experience of hearing all these physicians and researchers and families of ill people express to me that antibiotics are precious and that we need to protect them and we need to conserve their power. And yet here was agriculture using antibiotics literally, you know, by the ton, more than 30 million pounds a year in the United States going into livestock. And I felt called to investigate how those two things could exist in the same place and time and be so contradictory.
Wow. 30 million pounds per mm-hmm. year.
Mm-hmm.
That's hard to, like, even wrap your brain around, you know? That's just unbelievable. And so because they're using so many antibiotics with the animals, then when humans need the antibiotics to actually combat disease that they have, it's not working. Is that correct?
That's exactly right. You have identified the exact problem here. I mean, we ought to care about antibiotic overuse in agriculture because it undermines animal welfare, because it distorts the market for meat by making meat artificially cheap, and because it enables a style of farm structure that in which much more power is given to corporations than to individual farmers or to communities. But the most important reason, in addition to all the rest of those, that we should care about this is that antibiotic use on farms, in livestock, it's very clear, creates drug-resistant bacteria that move off farms either in the meat those animals become or in the manure they produce, which contaminates the environment and releases drug-resistant bacteria into the world that can then disseminate in a manner that is untrackable and causes grave illness. It is a substantial human health threat.
Mm-hmm. Now, I know that they're talking about trying to cut down on the use of antibiotics, but in order to do that, they have to change the whole structure of commercial livestock raising, don't they?
So,
because you can't crowd them all in those, those big animal.
The CAFOs, right? Confined animal.
CAFOs,
right.
And not
CAFO
give them antibiotics.
CAFO is a technical term for an industrial scale farm. Right. So when I started writing this book, which was in 2013, I thought that I was writing an expose of how nothing had ever changed and nothing would ever change in antibiotic use in livestock. And then events caught up with me, which caused me to rewrite the book several times. As of January 1st, 2017, we finally, after decades of inaction, did get some farm antibiotic regulation in the United States. So now one type of use of antibiotics, which is called growth promoters, the fattening aspect, that is supposedly banned in the United States. Preventive use, which allows animals to be crowded in so closely, that is still fully legal in the United States, and that's the next big policy hurdle, goal, the next big thing that needs to be changed. The contention that you hear that I've been hearing for years as I've been working on this book is that farming never can change because it's so held up by routine antibiotic use that if we took antibiotics out of the system, farms would just collapse. It turns out that that's not true, which means that there is hope for practical reform. And we know that it's not true because some large companies actually moved ahead of regulation and created their own antibiotic-free programs. The company that gets the most credit for this is the chicken company Purdue Farms, which is the fourth largest chicken company in the United States, which in 2014 announced to the shock of the rest of the poultry industry, that it was going to go antibiotic-free. And now, 4 years later, is almost it's like 99% antibiotic-free. And they managed to do that while keeping the size of their farms, the rate of production. They did things like change birds' diets, change their housing, start giving them herbs and beneficial bacteria and more vaccines and so forth. And they showed that it's possible to have very high throughput, high capacity protein production and not rely on antibiotics. And they really changed the poultry industry by doing that.
Hmm. Now, but you're saying they took away the antibiotics, but now they're giving them vaccines and other things. What are these other things that they're giving them to substitute for?
So,
they haven't changed the way that they cram them into these CAFOs, have they?
That's true. These are still very large, very crowded, very large properties for the production of protein. And whether you
right,
think
so,
so
it's not raising the quality of life for the animals. There's nothing about that has changed, correct?
It's correct that they are still raising them in the same degree of concentration. Now, I've been on a lot. I went on a lot of farms in order to report this book, and I learned that there are very different points of view about the degree to which industrial scale production is harming animal welfare. It is possible to. I have seen that it is possible to have these farms in which the birds are, you know, not unhealthy. They are not. They are not crippled. They are not sick. They're also not. They're not going outside, and they're not expressing their natural behaviors. But taking antibiotics out of the system does not automatically dismantle the system.
Mm-hmm. Right. Right. And how is this use of the antibiotics that they use on the animals? How's that different than how antibiotics are used in medicine?
Oh, incredibly different. So in medicine, we only use antibiotics to cure infections, except in some very rare cases when someone might, for instance, might have a heart defect and therefore gets antibiotics prophylactically so they won't won't be subject to the risk of a heart infection when they're having a surgery or a dental surgery or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And there are some other surgeries for which antibiotics are given in a preventive manner beforehand, but for a very short period of time. Overwhelmingly, we use antibiotics to cure infections, to kill disease bacteria. But most of the antibiotic use in livestock is not to cure infections. Most of the animals aren't sick. What happens instead is they get antibiotics in their feed and water, and the antibiotics affect the balance of bacteria in their guts. And they either turn those bacteria toward absorbing nutrition in a different way so that the animals get put on weight more quickly, or they kill the disease bacteria as the animals are taking them in so that they are preventing diseases from happening. But if we did those things in human medicine, we would consider either of those to be completely inappropriate use. And the key thing about inappropriate use, which is what medicine calls using antibiotics badly, is that anytime we use an antibiotic, we are taking the risk that resistant bacteria will emerge. Because what antibiotic resistance is disease bacteria's maneuvers to protect themselves against the action of the antibiotic that's meant to kill them.
Mm-hmm.
And a cure is enough of a benefit that the risk of resistance is worth it. But if we're not achieving a cure, then that equation of risk and benefit tips entirely over to the side of risk. If you haven't got a cure happening and you're just risking resistance, then it's inappropriate use. And that's what most agricultural use of antibiotics is.
Mm-hmm. And that, unfortunately, we see that even in medicine as well. I mean, I see so many doctors, you know, people going in and they have a cold and the doctor gives them, you know, antibiotics and, you know, and they have a virus and antibiotics.
That's exactly right.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but antibiotics do not help if you have a virus, right? It's
That's
for
correct.
Bacteria.
Antibiotics don't work against the flu. Antibiotics don't work against colds. And to be clear, the problem of antibiotic resistance is not only the fault of agriculture, because, as you say, there is plenty of antibiotic misuse in medicine as well. In fact, there is some good data that as much as maybe a third of antibiotic prescriptions given in an outpatient setting, that is like given in a doctor's office or a rapid clinic, a minute clinic, something like that, as much as a third of those may be inappropriate. So medicine certainly contributes to the problem. But just sheerly in terms of volume, again, remember, four times as many antibiotics being used in animals as in humans. Surely in terms of the volume of antibiotic being put into the world, agriculture has is playing a big role in the generation of resistance and needs to make significant reforms in order to make things more safe.
Mm-hmm. And now when you say that antibiotics are used also to make the animals grow bigger, that's different than the growth hormone when you hear that the animals are given growth hormone, correct?
That's right. So these antibiotics are not hormones, and people certainly have heard about the use of hormones in various kinds of meat. My book happens to be mostly about chicken, and hormones are not actually legal for use in chicken in the United States, though they are used in cattle. In fact, if you went to a supermarket and you picked up a package of chicken, it would almost certainly say no cages nor hormones. And both of those label claims, while true, are also sort of bogus, because it's illegal to raise meat animals in cages, and it's illegal to give hormones. Sorry, it's illegal to raise meat chickens in cages, and it's illegal to give hormones to meat chickens. But some chicken producer, no one can remember who, put both of those claims on their label, even though they don't get any particular credit for having claimed that. And now every poultry producer puts it on their label, because if they ever took it off, they think consumers would ask, well, are you the one that gives hormones then?
Right.
So growth promoter antibiotics, as they're called, are different from hormones. But what they do, and what they have been doing since the 1940s, when this was first discovered, is they cause animals to put to gain more quickly the tasty muscle that we want to eat. So you can raise animals more quickly on the same amount of feed, or you can use so you can get them through the process faster, or you can use a lesser amount of feed and get them through on kind of the natural cycle, the normal cycle that you would get them through on. Either way, it's a benefit to meat production to use growth promoters. And we did from 1951, when they were first licensed by the FDA, up until January 1st, 2017, growth promoters were a routine part of meat production in the United States.
But not chicken, just meat.
Chicken and cattle and pigs. Yeah, sorry. I count chicken as a meat.
Right. Okay. So for all of it. So it's only became illegal as of January 2017.
That's correct.
Wow. Yeah, because, you know, you also hear stories of, you know, young girls getting their periods earlier because of some of the hormones, and that, so that's different than the antibiotics. So that should not be happening anymore, or that you're saying the hormones are still in the meat, just not in chicken, correct?
To my knowledge, there is still use of hormones in cattle production, and that was not affected by the antibiotic rules.
Mm-hmm. Wow. So our country's trying to control that. I know I recently heard that McDonald's was trying to switch to all antibiotic-free chicken. What do you see as the role of food companies like a McDonald's or food producers in pushing to change the industry?
So there's a really interesting dynamic that has gone on here. You know, I told you the story of Purdue Farms, the fourth largest chicken producer in the U.S., who led the industry by going antibiotic-free. And just a couple of months after Purdue Farms made that announcement, the chicken sandwich chain Chick-fil-A also announced that they were going antibiotic-free. And this is symbiotic, right? Because the producers grow the birds and produce the meat, and then the food service companies take the meat and turn it into a product that they sell to us. And so after Purdue came Cargill and Tyson and Pilgrim's Pride and Foster Farms and a number of the other chicken producers all decided that they would have to go antibiotic-free too. And after Chick-fil-A came McDonald's North America and Taco Bell and Subway and so forth, all of those food service companies all announcing they would be buying antibiotic-free meat. And the reason that both of them, both sectors did that is because consumers signaled to them that there would be, if they took this step, there would be a market. These companies actually started making their moves before the U.S. regulations were changed. And the reason that they felt safe in making their moves is there was a vast consumer movement out there starting in about, I would guess, about 2010, that very large buyers, places like hospital systems, which, you know, were buying food for their cafeterias and to feed to all their patients. Hospital systems said to the meat production industry, we are not going to spend our procurement dollars anymore on buying meat raised with routine use of antibiotics because we fear the bacteria on it will endanger our vulnerable patients. The very first health system to do this was the University of California. And then after health systems came school systems. The very first was the Chicago Public Schools, who also said, we want to buy antibiotic-free meat. And behind the power of those very large buyers came sort of individual buyers, you know, many, many families and moms and chefs saying to the meat companies, do things differently, and we will reward you by being enthusiastic customers. When Purdue made their change, they told me, they did it in part because they were getting 3,000 consumer complaints a month through social media and Facebook and email and so forth, asking them why they were still using antibiotics. And so, I mean, to me, as part of this tangled history, one of the unqualifiedly positive parts of it is that consumers really showed their buying power and helped an industry convert to a healthier mode of production.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And my guest today is Maren McKenna, and she's the author of The Big Chicken, and we're talking about the use of antibiotics in poultry raising and what can be done about it and how it is changing. So, Maren, welcome back.
Thank you.
How do you see the future going here? You know, now with the pressure that we're getting from consumers and the changes that some of these fast food companies are making to demand it, can we produce enough chickens that are antibiotic free and hormone free to fill the need from the likes of McDonald's and Burger King and Chick-fil-A?
So I think where we are right now is at a moment that's really positive, but is also pretty fragile for a couple of reasons. The first is that these rules that I told you about that made growth promoter antibiotic use illegal in the United States, they only addressed one of the two major uses of antibiotics in livestock, and the other is that prevention of disease in crowded quarters. Those new rules don't really address how prevention happens. They put antibiotics under the control of veterinarians instead of allowing farmers to buy them over the counter, but they still allow preventive use, and that is a very, very substantial amount of antibiotics. Changing preventive use, which has been done in a few countries in Europe, is really the next policy hurdle. But, you know, it's pretty clear that since the last policy change was with the Obama administration, that the current administration, the Trump administration, has a very different point of view about increasing regulation. So I don't think we're going to get that change for a while. The second is that as positive as things are, and that the U.S. rule change followed by more than a decade, a profound rule change in Europe controlling antibiotics on farms, Western Europe and North America together are practically just a rounding error to the developing economies of the world, to Brazil and India and China, where emerging middle classes with more money to spend are starting to spend that money on meat. those countries are facing rising demand for meat, And it is going to be a real challenge to persuade them to not indulge in the bad antibiotic-using habits that we in the West indulged in for a very long time. It's really the developing economies, whether they're eating land-based protein like chicken and pigs or ocean-based protein like farmed fish and shrimp. It's the developing economies that are really going to be the deciders of where antibiotic use is going to go. And it's very analogous to me to climate change, that the industrialized West made a number of mistakes with regard to emissions and realized we were getting ourselves into trouble and tried to lead the world to a reconsideration of climate change and emissions. But in the meantime, the developing economies said, wait a minute, you know, you had your gas guzzlers and your big fancy refrigerators and so forth, and we want those too. We don't want to miss that stage in our evolution where we get our air conditioners and our Chevys. Well, it's pretty simple with regard, you know, it's pretty similar to what's going on with antibiotic use in farming, that the West is starting to say, oh, man, we made a mistake when we invented industrial-scale farming and we made it dependent on antibiotics. It is essential that even if we're raising large amounts of protein, that we do it without antibiotic use. And so now we're at the moment where the developing economies are going to start building CAFOs. In fact, they already are. And it's going to be really important that the West attempt to lead those economies down a path of not making the same mistake with regard to antibiotic overuse. Because we already know that resistant bacteria cross borders. And there have been resistant bacteria as a result of farming emerging in European countries that have ended up in the United States, emerging in China and have ended up in the United States, have moved across the globe. You know, pathogens move in the oceans, on the breeze, on birds, in the bodies of human beings. And so we are not safe anywhere so long as antibiotics are being misused anywhere. And we all have to make a really global commitment to changing that.
You're so right. And, you know, the analogy with climate change is exactly that, because, you know, they want to benefit from the cheap way of raising animals that we did. And, you know, with climate change, we're asking them to, you know, clean up their emissions before they even get them bad. And, it's a very good analogy, but it is so important. I agree, for them to learn from our mistakes, but it's really hard when we have, you know, the administration that we have right now who is not really on board with this.
Absolutely. In fact, just a month or two ago, I think the World Health Organization put out a statement calling on governments all over the world to take as much antibiotic use out of agriculture as possible, and that includes preventive use, you know, preventing animals from catching the diseases of crowding. And the Trump administration pretty much said, no, we're not going to do that. We do not think this is an appropriate thing for the World Health Organization to say. So I think we know that as long as this administration continues, that we won't get any policy change on antibiotic use in agriculture. But we can hope that consumers will show their muscle, as they did with growth promoters, and that consumer action will convince companies to change their behavior in advance of any kind of regulatory change.
Mm-hmm. Which is what we are seeing happening now. And, you know, that's why, you know, as at the beginning of my show, you know, I always talk about people power. People need to really take these issues to heart and to become active citizens to demand better animal husbandry, better use of antibiotics, better use of pesticides and herbicides on our fields, because it all affects our planet and affects the future generations. And, I mean, everything's so connected. And I think people just don't keep up the pressure and remember that, because it is so important for
us companies
all to need take
the companies want a market. You know, companies are very pragmatic. They will do what they can sell. And if consumers say to them, we want you to do better and we're not going to buy the products you're giving us now, they will change. They did. We know they will because they did. Now, this evolution is not over. Not just because we haven't gotten a full renunciation of antibiotics, but also because at the moment the change is mostly in poultry. And poultry was kind of the easy place to start. It's very fortunate that a poultry company started this, but also, you know, chickens are small. They can be confined in relatively small areas, and they don't live very long. We allow industrial birds to live an average of 42 days in the United States. Pigs and cattle are more complicated. Not only do they live much longer, which makes them more just naturally more vulnerable to disease because they have a longer time to be exposed, but in the process of their raising, they also get moved around more. So chickens are deposited in a barn on their third day of life, and they don't leave that barn until the night they're killed. But pigs might get born in one barn and moved to another. Cattle get born on one farm and then moved to another farm or to a feedlot. So every time they move, they have a higher risk of being exposed to disease bacteria. Mm-hmm. So it will.
Now, fish also, they're also doing this with farm-raised fish now, right? All the farm-raised fish, they're crowded and they're in these bins and they get, you know, there's disease, so they just prophylactically give antibiotics to farm-raised fish.
It's true,
correct?
As it happens, just this past week, I was in Chile speaking at a conference, and Chile has a massive salmon aquaculture industry. And Chile is really feeling the pressure right now because they lost a significant number of contracts to the country of Norway, which also has salmon farming that uses very little antibiotics. Costco decided to stop buying Chilean salmon and buy Norwegian salmon instead because of their concern about antibiotics. So, again, the market is speaking and telling producers you have to find other ways to do your production because our consumers are demanding something better.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, and I also ask my listeners to take it even another step further when you go to restaurants. You know, if you ask the restaurant, the server, you know, what chicken do you have that's antibiotic-free, or, you know, what meat do you have that's antibiotic-free and hormone-free? You know, do you have any organic meat? You know, the more that consumers start asking for this, the more restaurateurs are going to start thinking about more about where they get their meat from and
what kind
of meat they're serving.
There's no substitute for people just making themselves heard. Because otherwise, how would that restaurant know that its customers cared? How would that supermarket know that its customers cared if people don't keep asking questions? If the market knows that consumers are alert to this issue and concerned about it, I really do think the market adapts.
Mm-hmm. And so when you were in Chile, what were they looking at changing their way of raising salmon
because it was very clear to me that the country is very concerned about it. I went to speak at a conference that was sponsored by the Chilean Senate. And once it became known that I was talking about antibiotic use and that antibiotic use is an issue in their industry, I think I did 12 interviews with newspapers and radio and television and so forth during the time I was down there. It's clearly mm-hmm. something that people are thinking about.
Right, right. Well, that's heartening, you know. I mean, I think the more that people start thinking about these things, and like you said, we need the pressure. And so I want to thank you for your book and for the writing that you do about this. You know, I was reading some of your work on, the fear that people have with diseases. I mean, I was teaching in a hospital at the time when, the AIDS epidemic was first coming out, and doctors were like I was teaching women's health issues, and doctors were putting on gloves to like do a breast exam because they were afraid of touching people's skin, you know. And I was like, you know, sometimes doctors are role models, and they spread paranoia and fear where it just does not need to be. You know, I mean, people were afraid to hold people's hands to help them walk across the street because you might catch AIDS, you know, and it just doesn't work like that. And so anyway, the work that you're doing and, you know, bringing things to reality is just so appreciated. So thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me today. I really appreciate the chance to speak to your audience about this very important issue.
You're very welcome. And everyone out there, thank you so much for joining me. You've been listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. Have a great rest of the week, and I'll see you again next week. Bye for now.